You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, in Belgium and elsewhere, the hunt continues for the network behind Tuesday's terror attacks. My guests Michael Goldfarb and Sebastian Borger will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the United States claims to have killed yet another senior member of Islamic State, President Barack Obama's visit to Argentina, and Turkey's ongoing persecution of the country's newspapers. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And you are welcome to the programme. Welcome to Midori House. That is, my guests today are Michael Goldfarb, reporter, author and broadcaster, currently writing for politico.eu, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, among others. Welcome both. We will start with Brussels again tonight, as authorities in Belgium and elsewhere continue attempting to roll up the network responsible for Tuesday's bombings at Zaventem Airport and Malbeek metro station, which killed 31 people and injured many dozens more. Among recent developments, a man shot by police and arrested in the Schaerbeek district of Brussels, 10 suspects held in Belgium, France and Germany, and a stepping up of security at Belgium's nuclear power plants. Michael, first of all, is it possible to be certain of how much of this is doing something and how much of it is wanting to give the appearance that things are being done?
No, I think that this is doing something. Apparently, you know, there's this close relationship between whatever cell carried out the Bataclan atrocity and carried out the atrocity the other day in Brussels. And I think that the French security services are now, and police services are interacting in a highly cooperative way with their Belgian colleagues. And because this is a cross-border group of people, it's likely that this is not just being seen to do something after the fact, but is in fact pushing to get to roll up the rest of the network, which all reports indicate is at least 6 or 7 people still out there who are part of this network.
Sebastian, from the point of view of continental Europe as a whole, how great a manifestation of fear is this, the idea of a network at large spanning different European countries? And do you get the sense so far that the law enforcement authorities are up to that kind of joined-up cooperation?
Extremely unpleasant, isn't it? And I understand that the former CIA director today told us that his bilateral cooperation with European security services were very good, whereas he thought the intra-European cooperation wasn't. And to be honest, you know, the atrocities in Paris are now 4 months ago. We knew on the day after that at least one, possibly two, possibly more of these guys came from Brussels. If the French and the Belgians didn't start cooperating extremely closely on the day after, then I really don't know what they're there for.
Well, it's not just that breakdown of intranational police forces. There's the intra-Belgian police forces difficulties as well. We've had this absolutely incredible admission today by police in Mechelen near Brussels that they'd sat on information about Salah Abdeslam for months. There's no suggestion that this was anything other than just basic disorganisation and incompetence. But how, Michael, how is... And with all due recognition that people who operate a police force do a much difficult job than anybody who sits in a radio studio, but how is that even possible?
Well, in Belgium's case in particular, it's not just possible. I mean, it's become part of the culture. When we see films about Belgium, they're often about this nexus of corruption and incompetence between police forces, between politicians, between the French-speaking and the Flemish-speaking parts of the country. So Jonathan Rugman, who's a reporter here for Channel 4 News, put it as pithily and as painfully as possible yesterday when he said, there's better cross-border cooperation among terrorists in Europe than there is among security services.
I mean, I would take up that thought about us being in a rather cold but at least safe radio studio here, as opposed to people who are at the front line against terrorism. You know, let's remember that the Brits, who supposedly are comparatively rather good, missed out on the guys who then exploded their suicide bombs in the London Tube in July 2005.
This is true.
Even though they were very close and should have been much closer. We know that the German, in fact, my home country, Bavarian police forces, who within Germany are supposed to be fairly good, missed out on the guy who had a shed load of weapons in his car, and the GPS on his phone pointed to Paris. I mean, it's rather easy after the event to blame them, but it does seem to me to be the case that Belgium is a particular problem, and maybe it's time for the French and the Brits and the Germans to get together and knock them into shape.
I did just want to talk finally on this subject about the ongoing wider, I guess, international political reaction. We've had the US Secretary of State John Kerry loftily declaring "Je suis Bruxellois" this week, vowing to defeat Islamic State, etc. Michael, do you get the sense that we were talking about this on Midori House yesterday, and I suggested that these had become basically the European equivalent to American reaction to school shootings, that they've become sort of ritualistic, that, you know, no one really knows what to say after these things, so they just say the same thing every time.
Well, I think that it's not just this current wave, this current epidemic. It's not even an epidemic, it's a wave of Islamic State atrocities. I mean, I can remember, if you go back to the 80s and 90s, you had the same kind of pronouncements all the time. Anytime there was an IRA bombing, then it was on the mainland, meaning it was on the island of Britain. They blew up Manchester several times. Same pronouncements. Doesn't matter who's prime minister in the UK. Doesn't matter who's prime minister of the Republic of Ireland. The same kind of ritual. What else can you do? You know, because what happens is, when one of these things is successful and there is a bombing and people are killed, we're all shocked and horrified by it because, you know, it may be a rare occurrence, but it's a terrible way to go. But what it really means, of course, is that the security services had their unlucky day, because the phrase has never been bettered. You know, the IRA used to say, we only have to be lucky once in 100 times. You have to be lucky every day. So that's the way of things. And John Kerry turned up. Good for him.
Well, let's move along to an apparently related story, which is that US officials claim to have killed Islamic State's head of finance, Abid al-Rahman Mustafa al-Kaduli, aka Haji Imam, in either Syria or Iraq, in an operation which was either an airstrike or a special forces raid, although various plausible outlets do claim to have been told by defense officials that it was indeed a special forces raid and inside Syria. This follows last week's claimed dispatch of Islamic State's Minister of War, Omar al-Shashani, aka Omar the Chechen, in an airstrike. These are among several senior IS figures that the US claims to have killed in recent days. Sebastian, Ashton Carter, the Defence Secretary, has described this as, and I quote, systematically eliminating ISIL's cabinet. Is there much difference between doing that and playing whack-a-mole?
The first thing to say, of course, is that this was the acting finance minister, because the apparent, I don't know by what way they appoint these guys, but his predecessor, of course, was killed by the Americans late last year. I think it is a way of taking the war to people who are clearly bent on not just being very unpleasant to Syrians and Iraqis, but also threatening us here in Europe and the Americans.
I mean, clearly, Michael, it doesn't aid Islamic State's cause if their senior officialdom keeps getting bumped off on a regular basis. But does it do anything to deal with what strikes me, at least, as the wider problem, which is the appeal of Islamic State's ideology?
Well, I think that's an important point, Andrew. I mean, remember the reports that have come out about this, and I wouldn't have thought Ashton, the Pentagon's been wrong in the past, but Ashton Carter, the Secretary of Defense, would not have put his face in front of the cameras unless they were absolutely sure that this was the man they'd got. He had been, you know, he'd been part of the original al-Qaeda in Iraq group with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was killed in 2006 or 2007, I can't remember the precise year, and who was the most bloodthirsty person up to that point before ISIS was reconstituted. You can kill the leadership. There are plenty of people out there to have a similar ideology and worse, similar ways of behaving when involved in warfare. And, you know, if they're scoured out of Syria and Iraq, which would be a very good thing for Syria and Iraq, they'll turn up in Libya. Some will come back to Europe. And they are under pressure. I mean, I have to say that we don't get... I follow something called the Nineveh Reporters Network, which... the translation bot on their reports is hysterically funny, but I rely on their information. And there does seem to be at the moment the first stages of an offensive south of Mosul. So they're beginning to push back harder on ISIS.
Reports today, Syria claiming to have retaken the citadel
in Palmyra. So they are under some pressure, and it may well be that... their long-term plan is to go to Libya, but also to be, you know, secreting people back into Europe via Turkey, via this terrible wave of refugees, and in the chaos in Europe, maybe get a few bombs off. But it doesn't really matter in the long run, because the ideology reaches new people, and it's been out there much longer than we realize. It's only when it sets off bombs in Europe that you pay attention.
Sebastian, to return to the actual action that the US was claiming today, how significant does it strike you that they are happy to semi-confirm, at least, defense officials briefing media outlets that this was a special forces raid inside Syria on the ground? Does that suggest that the Americans are becoming more confident? I mean, we assume, obviously, that Western special forces have been at work in Syria for quite a long time now. But does this suggest that they're becoming more confident in how they can move and where they can move?
That looks like the obvious explanation, doesn't it? As you say, I think there's been people on the ground for many months. They must also have infiltrated the network fairly efficiently.
Well, they do seem to know where these people are.
Well, exactly. You need to get close to them. And you know, with the whole drone war, you know how terrible it looks when you make mistakes and kill civilians. And as far as I can see, in recent months, that hasn't happened. So that's, from my point of view, is a, you know, apart from that, it's all obviously terrible killing people, but it's much better killing the right people than the wrong people, I would have thought.
Michael, there has even been some suggestion that the original purpose of the raid, which killed Abd al-Rahman Mustafa al-Qaduli, was to take him alive. What on earth would you do with him once you'd done that?
Interrogate him? How ISIS has been able to finance itself is not a mystery, but there's a way of perhaps taking him alive and finding information from him, if that's indeed the case.
Let's take up the positive. I mean, honestly, we are. Quite rightly complaining, I think, about extrajudicial killings, which drone strikes in the end are, and the only justification for them is that you can't get people, you can't go to Raqqa and arrest people. Now, clearly, the Americans have found a way to at least go and try to arrest people. I think they ought to be commended for that.
And on that thought, Michael, there's been some suggestion of some good articles I've read recently which have talked about not just the military but the psychological effect of drone strikes and what that may have on potential recruits to Islamic State, because obviously being uncomprehendingly obliterated by something you never even saw coming possibly does not strike many as the most glorious form of martyrdom. if they start to get the sense that America is now able to operate to the extent that it's possible they can pick people off the battlefield alive, does that render the movement less appealing? Does it make it look less omnipotent?
I have no way of knowing. I think that the appeal is clearly, I mean, I'm not even sure that we've had accurate information about how many people have gone off to join, gone to Syria. But I'm reasonably certain that the ideology still has a great deal of appeal to particularly to young Muslims who may be second or third generation immigrants in Europe and in the United States, who feel so alienated and are quite willing to go out and die. And in North Africa, where people are congregating, in Libya, a similar thing. I'm just not sure. What it may do immediately in the vicinity is if there are more special forces out there, and I don't think we should overestimate how many might be there. The coalition, such as it is, has had special forces in Iraq and operating between Turkey and Syria for months, if not years. But I don't think that it's a great deal of guys yet. I just don't think so.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Michael Goldfarb and Sebastian Borger. Up next, Obama in Argentina.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into The Menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine. And he baked me a potato and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monaco's program on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippi, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. Vegetables, sorry, I said to say carrots, but I love carrots, so I meant vegetables in general.
You're welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Michael Goldfarb and Sebastian Borger. Now, President Barack Obama's visit to Havana earlier this week commanded headlines, and quite rightly. It was the first such visit by a US president in nearly a century, and it brought an end to America's decades-long policy of pointless isolation of Cuba, which accomplished little but preserving the tyranny it was supposed to undermine. Obama's subsequent trip to Argentina was obviously not as momentous, but it was nonetheless significant. Sebastian, first of all, he made a point of visiting a memorial to victims of the dirty war, as it was known, and being quite apologetic about America's role in that. Do you think that role is yet sufficiently understood in the United States, the degree to which America egged on the dictators and juntas of the 70s and 80s?
Well, I think amongst the people who care, it's very well known. But there's obviously quite a number of Americans, let's put it not more precisely than that, who don't care at all. I thought Obama, ever since he lost the midterms in 2014, has been unleashed, and that's another bit of that farewell foreign policy, which I think he's doing rather well. You know, he goes to a very pivotal country in South America, and strikes all the right notes as far as I can tell.
Nevertheless, Michael, some Argentinian human rights groups, including the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo, boycotted the event. How deep does resentment of the United States still run in Latin America?
Well, it depends on where. I think that there's always suspicion. I know some very, you know, people who in other circumstances would be very, very pro-American. And, for example, very right wing, you know, and they would say, what is America's problem with Cuba? I'm talking back in the 1980s, because they still see, there are gradations here, and they do see that Yankee imperialism does come with a tinge of racism attached to it, even though God knows Argentina is as European in its ethnicities as the United States, I suppose. There is, and so there's always skepticism about the big brother. That never changes. And of course, at this moment, you know, the government of Argentina is being sued because when they had their incredible crisis, when they unpegged the Argentinian peso from the dollar back in the last decade, they just defaulted on all of their obligations in the United States. And there are hedge funds in New Jersey who are spending tens of millions of dollars to get their money. So it's an odd relationship. And I think it's very interesting that Obama should choose to go to Argentina, because just to pick up Sebastian's point, it is not a country that registers much on American radar, except in the financial pages whenever this court case, you know, comes up. So it's an interesting thing for him to have gone, but he does seem to be enjoying his valedictory waltz around the world, and not waltz, tango around the world, because those pictures were, he's not a bad dancer, nor is his wife.
But Argentina, honestly, you also have to see that after these 10, 12 years of populism, that the Kirchner family, they now have a, shall we say, right of center, maybe even right wing president, who is much more inclined to do deals with America. I think the court case is nearing completion. They'll find a compromise. They must. And of course, I mean, there is a residual anti-Americanism. I mean, Michael is much too polite to say it, but of course, there's a residual anti-Americanism in South America, and it won't go away. Whoever is the president, whatever they say, whatever they do.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we will look at Turkey, which, as part of a deal over settlement of refugees, has recently won agreement from the EU that the EU will resume pretending that there's any chance of Turkey's accession talks ever going anywhere. Because for all Turkey's official pretenses to be a liberal democracy, it looks less like one every day that Recep Tayyip Erdogan stays in office. Today, the trial began of two of the more prominent of the many, many people arrested for affronting the hypersensitive president, Can Dündar and Erdem Gül of the Cumhuriyet newspaper, who were arrested in November and charged with revealing state secrets. Michael, they are far from the first or the last people arrested on basically just because President Erdogan doesn't like them very much. The trial has been adjourned, arguably appropriately, until April the 1st. Prosecutors have won a closed hearing, which is... My question is, as far as it's possible to tell, why isn't Turkey even bothering to pretend that this is a fair trial? Because usually, if you're going to subject somebody to a show trial, you make it at least look like it's a proper trial. They're not even trying.
No, they aren't. But I mean, who knows what goes on inside the mind of Tayyip Erdogan? You know, it's strange. You know, when he came to office back in 2003, the first thing he did was deny the United States the right to use Incirlik Airport or to land troops in Turkey to have a northern flank or northern prong of the invasion of Iraq. And in that, he was reflecting about 90% of the Turkish people did not want to be involved in the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. And I was there and I thought, wow, how interesting. Here's an elected politician who is actually reflecting the will of the people and not being bent to the will of the global hegemon. And then year by year, it's become clear that he wasn't reflecting the will of the people. He was reflecting his own will. He has taken it into his head. He's quoted just after the bombing, the latest bombing in Ankara. He said, "There is no difference between a terrorist with a gun and those who work with a pen. And it doesn't matter if you're an author or a journalist or you run a large NGO, if you are giving succor in some way to people we consider to be terrorists, you are a terrorist." And so he's...
That is an extraordinary statement, isn't it?
Well, and I must say, not reported in the Western press. I just found that...
Extraordinary is a charitable choice of adjective. There are others I could use.
Yeah, but I mean, look, this was an Al Monitor. I mean, I would have thought this would have been something that would have been big news. But, you know, in Europe in particular, because the European leadership is so desperate for help to stem the flow of refugees coming out of Syria via Turkey over the water to Greece, they will say anything. And he can have show trials. And let's not forget what the Kamouriet trial is about. This is arguably the last really independent newspaper left in Turkey, and their investigative journalists had found that there was a racket of selling arms to rebels in Syria, and they had found it via the Turkish army, and they just reported it. It's precisely the kind of thing that would win you a Pulitzer Prize in America, but here it got the newspaper seized, and these two top journalists. It's like having the New York Times senior editor and his number
New York bureau chief, yeah.
Yeah, sent to jail and then tried, you know, behind closed doors. That's the level that we're talking about.
Sebastian, to follow up on that point of Michael's, that the EU is doing all it can not to upset Erdogan untowardly, is he now just proceeding on the assumption he can do as he likes and nobody's going to stop him?
Can I first of all say, I totally share Michael's contempt for Mr. Erdogan. The problem, it seems to me, is that he does reflect the majority of the people in Turkey. What we have to face is that there is very little well-organized opposition in the country.
And it's also that thing, isn't it, that Turkey is not Istanbul in the way that the United States is not New York.
Exactly. And we don't reckon with the tremendous following he has in the rural countryside. And unfortunately, the elections may not have been entirely fair, I grant you that, but he did win a number of times, time and time again. Also, of course, he's making very good use of the disarray in the Kurdish region and the Kurdish leadership after we were very hopeful, weren't we, that there was this Democratic Party making a very good impact in the Turkish parliament, and it all seems to have dissipated. The European attitude is shameful, I agree. But, I mean, we are faced with a very difficult situation where realpolitik and the idealistic ideas of some politicians, not least my own chancellor in Germany, collide very badly. And he seems to be in a position which lets him get away with almost anything, I agree.
Michael, as Sebastian points out, it's not like President Erdogan has no mandate. He actually has quite a big one. He is, whatever we may think of him, popular. That being the case, where does this extraordinary sensitivity come from? It's not just this case. It's the Zaman newspaper, which was seized and nationalised in recent weeks. 1,845 charges at least have been filed against people for insulting him since he became president.
I'm not sure. Just remember that never underestimate what a spell in prison might do to build up resentments. I mean, Erdogan came up in a very rough district of Istanbul and is he's a big city politician. I mean, we know what this type is like. We see it in Chicago. It's famous in Chicago. Think of him as Richard Daley, but instead he's president of the country.
Which is a fearsome thought.
But he did, in fact, I mean, people... because nobody paid attention to Turkey until suddenly, you know, a million people from Syria were coming through Turkey to Europe.
No, we did. Sorry, we did
no,
pay attention.
No, I know. Of course.
We did pay attention.
Germans,
we thought
pay attention.
Germans
pay attention to Turkey because you know, on a holiday weekend like this weekend, half of Hamburg drives back home to Turkey to enjoy warm weather. No, I know what you mean, Sebastian. Finish the thought. I'm sorry, I didn't
mean to. No, also, I just mean there was a comparatively, we thought, mild Islamist, and we thought that was a way of getting along with that rather unpleasant ideology.
We have seen it in country after country in this part of the world. He has sons, and he wants to pass the country on to the sons in the same way that Hosni Mubarak wanted to pass his country, Egypt, on to his sons. It's the way business is done.
Gentlemen, we will have to leave it there, with Turkey ranking 149th out of 180 in Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index. That's one spot above the Democratic Republic of Congo. Michael Goldfarb and Sebastian Borger, thank you very much for joining us. That's all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippy, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mari Giusti. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's more music next. Marcus is in with the menu at 1900. The Daily follows up the day's main stories at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday. I think I'm your host for that as well. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Enjoy the rest of your Easter.